excessive use of force and destruction of personal property. Reported cases of police violence have included minors being tear-gassed, a tent with a refugee inside being dragged by a tractor, and an Eritrean man shot in the face with a rubber bullet from 10 meters away, hospitalizing him for 2 months. The evictions by French police were on a rolling 48-hour schedule to prevent refugees acquiring limited rights and the police requiring a court order to clear the land. Abdul, a 20-year-old from Sudan who has been in Calais for 5 months, camping in the bushes in the hope of one day crossing to the United Kingdom by boat or lorry, said, "They come at 5 a.m. local time, circle around your tent and cut it with knives." He added, "It has happened to me so many times. They treat us like animals, not humans. In Sudan there is war, people are killed, women are raped, but in some ways it is better than here." Nasser, an Afghan refugee who turned 18 in December, said the constant evictions had affected his mental health. He said, "The police keep coming. You would think maybe if it is raining they would not come, but they do. They even came on New Year's Day when everyone was happy and it was a holiday. They take our stuff and we have to be outside for many hours, sometimes up to 10 to 12 hours. They don't care if I'm a minor." Most evictions are carried out using flagrants, a measure which allows police to remove occupants of private land if there has been a complaint and they have been there for less than 48 hours. Some lead to arrests and deportations, but often refugees flee and later return. Lawyers say the evictions are harassment and a breach of United Nations and French human rights laws. With the emergency measure intended for gathering facts about a crime deployed wrongly and permanently. Margot Siffre, who specializes in evictions for legal support charity Cabane Juridique, said, "It is a complete abuse of the system." She added, "Under normal circumstances, an eviction requires the authorization of a judge, a social diagnosis to identify vulnerable people, and preparation to provide rehousing solutions. But under flagrance, which should be a short-term measure, there is no legal basis and no opportunity to appeal." Bastien Roland, a lawyer working in Calais, said the tactics were deliberately vague and difficult to contest. Bastien Roland added, "The government spends millions of euros to slow these refugees down. They will still try to cross to England, but with how many traumas?" Larger scale evictions, described as sheltering operations involving the dispersal of refugees to centres around the country, are carried out by French authorities through court orders. On 29th of September, for example, nearly 800 people were evicted in an area known as Hospital, one of 15 such operations last year. After the destruction of the Calais jungle camp in 2016 and another large makeshift camp last September, the evictions are seen by the French authorities as a key weapon in preventing similar fixing points being established by the estimated 1,200 refugees now in Calais and Dunkirk, which includes pregnant women and children. Humanitarian groups working in northern France say that in recent months conditions have worsened and that the evictions have become relentless. About 150 people now sleep under the bridges in Calais city centre, where charities are banned from distributing food. But on 24th of December, an order for eviction was granted by the Administrative Court in Lille, which is expected to take place imminently. Mohamed, a 17-year-old Algerian national currently sleeping under the Molien Bridge, said, "I don't know what I will do if they evict us." He added, "The strategy is to weaken us, but if everything was fine in our countries, we wouldn't have left our countries. We don't have the choice." The prefecture of Pas-de-Calais said in a statement that the evictions put an end to illegal occupations with a twofold objective: to prevent the reconstitution of insalubrious camps and to provide shelter for migrant population. It claimed the action of the police during these operations responds to strict rules of ethics.
The British military complex is a shadow of its former empirical past, plagued by huge budget deficits, deteriorating equipment, and a very demoralised group of staff. Therefore, in order to bolster the bank balance, the British have leaned on their experience in the service sector and have turned their military into a training facilitator for paying customers. Following a Freedom of Information request by an anti-arms sales group, it's become apparent that the UK military has recently been responsible for training foreign military forces from over 150 countries around the world, equating to some two-thirds of the global countries, and has included tasks from battle training to military band practice. Whereas this could be seen as a sensible way of making money, the reality is that some 15 of the countries who have paid for the training have been rebuked by the British authorities for violations of human rights abuses, raising the question as to just how serious the British are when it comes to human rights and why they would agree to train such countries.
This is a difficult situation, and the opposition parties in Parliament have raised the question. The campaigning organisation at the centre of the current story, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, has tried through the courts to bring into force a more coherent British ethical foreign policy. But that has not happened so far, and the Ministry of Defence considers that its relationships, particularly with certain Gulf monarchies, is very strong and important for Britain, and therefore it is basically giving them a green card to go ahead with do what they want.
Media spokesman for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, Andrew Smith, was quoted as saying that the Act raises a very serious question for the British government, asking why they are so readily willing to support countries that apply repressive laws and have been accused of torture or have a known history of human rights violations. Yet the British government and military complex downplayed the allegations, stating that such cooperation was merely part of the statecraft designed to improve international diplomatic relations, claiming that all decisions are made on a country-by-country basis. Yet with the UK on its knees financially from the impact of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems that when it comes to income, one can turn a blind eye to certain events, as every little helps when it comes to earning money. When the former British Prime Minister Theresa May travelled to the Persian Gulf to meet the leaders of Bahrain, the sole intention of the visit was to represent and sell British-made weapons to the island, and is something that's emulated today with other such nations in the West Asia region. With Saudi Arabia also a loyal customer of Britain when it comes to the arms trade, it seems that money flowing in from the arms trade to Britain is enough to divert attention away from the repressive regimes that they sell to. In fact, the Saudi-led war on Yemen is a prime example of such oppression, with Saudi bombs killing over 100,000 people in the country, making up nearly half of the 233,000 people who have lost their lives as a direct or indirect result of the war on Yemen. With the supply of arms knowingly being sold to the Saudis to perform such actions, are then the British not an accomplice to the crimes being committed by Riyadh? And if so, should the UK not be sanctioned for their role in the deaths of so many innocent civilians?
Well, certainly there's been concern expressed about British training for sniper forces in Bahrain, given the efforts of Bahrain Defence Force against the Shia majority population in certain situations. And then, of course, British support through the arms trade for the Saudi led coalition's efforts in the war in Yemen since 2015. So this is something which is certainly full of contradictions. And again, the opposition parties in Parliament have raised these questions, would like to see the policies changed. But at the moment, there is no chance of that happening so long as Boris Johnson and his Conservative ministers are in power.
Yet the truth of the matter is that Britain itself is guilty of human rights abuses and has been demonstrated throughout time, with atrocious allegations being made against British soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course a lot closer to home in the treatment of the people of the north of Ireland during the Troubles, which saw British soldiers committing acts that will long remain in the memories of the victims, hence proving that Britain has no moral values when it comes to certain issues.
The coronavirus pandemic, which resulted in prolonged lockdowns and tough preventive measures, has had an adverse effect on the global economy. Like any other crisis, countries responded differently to the COVID-19 outbreak, which determined the extent of their success in tackling the ill effects of the disease. Take China, for example, the world's second largest economy. It was bound to overtake the United States as the biggest economy in 2030. But according to economists, the Asian country is expected to pass the U.S. 2 years earlier, as its gross domestic product is forecast to expand by more than 8% this year alone.
I would think that the Chinese economy would overtake the U.S. economy before then, very shortly, because the Chinese government, under the leadership of President Xi Jinping, they're proceeding with a completely different economic political orientation. They see development of infrastructure and industry as primary. And of course, they've uplifted, removed from poverty almost 800 million people, which is close to three times the size of the United States.
Moreover, China is the only major economy to have avoided contraction in 2020. This was despite an ongoing economic war between Washington and Beijing. U.S. President Donald Trump levied massive tariffs on Chinese imports to offset Beijing's trade surplus with Washington. But experts argue that the U.S. lackluster handling of the coronavirus ironically gave China the economic advantage. That begs the question, what would be the upcoming U.S. administration's response to this reality? And how is Washington going to adjust its policy toward its biggest competitor? Over the past 4 years, Donald Trump's America First policy took U.S. protectionism to a new level. Trump started trade wars with allies and foes alike, ripped up trade deals, and made attempts to play against international trade rules. In hindsight, those attempts, which were predominantly made to hinder China's economic growth, have proven counterproductive. China's success to rein in the COVID-19 pandemic helped Beijing solidify its position in the global economy. Now, many American and European firms are more likely to focus on China, considering its potential to be the only large source of growth after the pandemic ends.
And under President Trump, he had a misguided conception. In fact, it's not clear he had a clear conception of what is unique about American economic policy, such as I identified the founding of our economic principles from Alexander Hamilton through Franklin Roosevelt and even into John F. Kennedy. understood the role of infrastructure in building up our economy and the role of the state. President Trump wanted to reduce the role of the state and believed that economic wealth was measured by the stock market.
President-elect Joe Biden has vowed to put an end to U.S. isolationism.
America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it. Once again, sit at the head of the table.
But achieving the leading role for the U.S. would be much harder now, considering 4 years of Trump's attempts to retreat from international norms. Also, the success of Biden's China policy, which involves creating an alliance to counter Beijing's growing clout across the world, is questionable.
It's not clear to me what President Biden's policies will be. He has surrounded himself with people from the Obama administration, primarily some from the Clinton administration. They have a pronounced anti-China bent to them. The Democrat Party is also very anti-China, as is the leadership of the Republican Party.
Trump entered the Oval Office with the promise of making America great again. What transpired in the past 4 years, however, left the country in a far different position than what the outgoing U.S. president had pledged.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day drill in central Iran. During the massive military exercises, the IRGC targeted and destroyed the mock enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the large-scale military exercise, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, kicked off on Friday. IRGC units launched a barrage of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, which were followed by operations by offensive bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC's missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. A mixed attack involving a new generation of surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and drones was carried out, and all designated targets were destroyed with pinpoint accuracy. The mocked strikes were launched with the presence of the chairman of the Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said that Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said the country's armed forces will respond with all might in the shortest time if any adversary had malicious intentions toward the Islamic Republic.
Choosing a barrage of long-range missiles against naval targets illustrates that if the enemies of the Islamic Republic have ill intentions against our national interests, maritime trade routes and territory, they will come under missile strike and will be destroyed.
Donald Trump had attempted through his sanctions to withdraw the JCPOA to weaken Iran. This has not happened, and these exercises certainly demonstrate that. He had wanted Iran in a position that any of those countries, the United States, Israel, or Saudi Arabia, could successfully invade and attack and conquer Iran. But by these exercises, military exercises that have recently been held, Iran has demonstrated that these sanctions have failed, that Iran remains a strong, powerful country dedicated to protecting its people, assisting its allies, and will certainly not surrender or give in to or be vulnerable to attack by its enemies.
The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its naval drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparation and military prowess of the country's armed forces. The IRGC military exercise came after Iranian Navy's drills codenamed Ehtedar-e-Daryai 99. The two-day drills were held in the Sea of Oman and the Persian Gulf. A week prior to that, Iran held a massive drone maneuver across half of the country. These drills were launched amid heightened tensions between Iran and the U.S. in the final days of Donald Trump's presidency. Tensions have been simmering between the two countries in the past couple of months as the U.S. increases military presence in the region.
These exercises, I think, have been very important strategically for Iran in relation to the United States, because they have demonstrated, as I mentioned earlier, that the sanctions have not worked. So it is in the United States government under Joe Biden, it's in the U.S. government's interest to respect Iran, to re-enter the JCPOA, and to deal with Iran as another global citizen, trading with it, allowing trade with other countries, and working with it in a peaceful manner. These exercises have been a show of strength.
Last month, two U.S. B-52 bombers flew over the region. The move marked Washington's third dispatch of nuclear-capable bombers to the region in less than 2 months. The U.S. Navy had earlier announced the arrival of a nuclear-powered submarine in the Persian Gulf. The USS Georgia passed the Strait of Hormuz accompanied by two American warships, making it the first missile-loaded submarine of its kind to enter the region in 8 years. Analysts say these moves can signal Trump's intentions for triggering a conflict with Iran in his final days in office in order to distract attention from a string of failures in the past couple months. Many others say the outgoing U.S. president is simply seeking to complicate his successor's plans in coming back to the negotiating table with Iran over the nuclear deal. They say the U.S. president could be thinking about saddling President-elect Biden with some kind of military operation which could damage his efforts to come back to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. However, Tehran says it will respond to any hostile action with a strong attack and maximum power.
As more evidence comes to light as to just who was involved in the protests that saw five people die in the storming of the US Capitol building, it seems that many of those involved were serving or ex-military staff, raising the question as to just how right-wing the US actually leans. So serious is the situation that the Pentagon has launched a probe into extremist views from within the US military complex, as the body finally comes to terms and accepts that racism is rooted deep within the American system. Since the Pentagon has now acknowledged the problem, this raises the question as to whether the activities of those serving in the military and were part of the mob that broke into the Capitol actually broke more than just one law in the process.
Absolutely. In fact, these military officers that have been complicit, and it's not just the military, not just the Department of Defense, but also elected officials such as Senator Hawley, and also the police officers who we have seen on video leading these so-called insurrectionists into the Capitol, supporting them, taking photos with them. These are absolutely illegal and pose a big problem for the ruling class, because these people, these institutions, are the armed wing of the ruling class. They are there to protect the bourgeoisie. They are there to protect these elected officials and their rule of law.
However, the allegations are nothing new, as the U.S. military has long been known to have racist views, as well as openly recruiting members of far-right or white supremacist groups. A report in the Guardian newspaper 6 months ago saw that the U.S. military had already conducted a report into racism, showing that over a third of personnel had witnessed acts of racism in the service, a figure that's risen by some 14% since Trump took office. It also became apparent that many leaders within the white supremacists and far-right groups in the U.S. were either serving or veterans of the U.S. military, hence clearly linking the military-like discipline within such groups to the actual military body within the United States. Yet, as mentioned, this is nothing new, as the U.S. has long displayed such traits. But what is apparent is the alarming and dramatic rise in such incidents, likely sparked by one very obvious catalyst. As Donald Trump finds himself ever more estranged from the Grand Old Party and the presidency of the United States, his 4 years in the White House have left a legacy that no US president would be proud of, in particular when it comes to dealing with the diversity within his own nation. The endorsement of numerous acts of racial violence, discrimination and protest has left Trump leaving the White House having divided his nation. So many of his actions have actively encouraged and incited white supremacist groups to take a stand in the name of the so-called American Constitution. Trump also failed to deal with the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd by white police officers in Minneapolis. Had he done this promptly, it may just have given him another 4 years in the Oval Office. Trump has, in essence, created a divided and apartheid nation, something that incoming Joe Biden will no doubt have to reunite in his first term as president. However, with Trump very much still active in the background, the task is something that Biden must tackle head-on in order to resolve. With Trump having set the conditions to thrive, the question that now remains to be asked is whether Trump's legacy will lead to a civil or race war within the United States, whether he's in office or not.
Well, the empire is in decline, but it is not anywhere near ready to collapse. We might spend decades, we might spend maybe a year, but it will be time before the empire is collapsing and there will be those factions. The only future that the United States has is either a socialist one or a fascist one. And this battle will have to come eventually, but we're not anywhere near it yet. But the divisions are very deep.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
The limelight.
As Brexiteers turn on each other, Brexit politics moves fast. Until now, the Tories plan to move on, only reviving Brexit-done triumphalism to re-arouse the captured red wall at the election. Labour just wanted to bury the whole issue. We now present you an article written by Polly Toynbee under the heading Brexiteers are waking up to the damage they've done. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Polly Toynbee's article. Brexit has breached the fishing boats at Hastings, a seaside town and borough in East Sussex on the south coast of England. The two-man crew of Paul Joy's boat, Kaya, have left for shore jobs after the price of the Hastade land fell to just 2 pence a kilo. Exports to the European Union are Brexit blighted, with fishers across Britain pulled axe by the new costs and regulations. Their catches rotting before they reach the European Union markets. It's costing them millions of pounds already. For the last 2 years, Joy, a passionate Brexiteer, has consistently told me he believes his industry would be shafted in any trade deal. Outraged at the UK government's failure to secure British fishing rights for 12 miles around the coast, he says betrayed, sacrificed, and now crippled by the export costs. So when Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has the effrontery to tell the BBC's Andrew Marr that this is a great deal for the fishing industry, he must know it's not true. Other industries want to know if Boris Johnson's promised compensation for fishing losses means a huge subsidy in perpetuity for this less than 0.2% sliver of the economy. Because of the problems exploding in one industry after another, in less than 3 Brexit weeks, are not going away. Friction is the new normal. As recently, the chief European Union negotiator Michel Barnier said firmly, things have changed for good. UK choices mean mechanical, obvious, inevitable consequences when you leave the single market, and that's what the British wish to do. It's not French revenge or bloody-minded Brussels, but ordinary life as a third country. The plight of the fishers is just a vivid emblem for the new blow that is falling on exporting parts of the economy. British politician and former journalist Michael Gove's December warnings of bumpy moments upped an octave in the first week of this year. To Britain, should prepare for significant border disruption. That well-staged last-minute deal melodrama was designed to end Brexit stories, relegating all boring details of the aftermath to the business pages. But not so. The stories are so strong even the ardent Brexit-creating press can't resist them, though now those newspapers add a self-exculpatory slant that blames the government for a bad Brexit. Here are some random discoveries since Brexit Day. The Sun warns of Brexit's threat to the Cheltenham Festival. Last year, 180 Irish horses ran, but this year, Brexit leaves Irish racehorse trainers fearing colossal tax bill. Likewise, the cost of taking UK show jump horses across the Channel is prohibitive for their British owners. Motorsport faces similar fees for cars shipped to European Union racers. The fashion industry, especially ASOS type, cheap end with small margins, is hitting a rules of origin crisis, paying new duties on its many products manufactured outside the European Union. Fun stories in The Sun include the lorry driver crossing the Gibraltar-Spain border, whose bottle of Nando's sauce is confiscated, along with all those ham sandwiches snatched by the Dutch. The Daily Telegraph reports the fight of Europeans from England, but not from Remain-voting Scotland and Northern Ireland. Farmers Weekly sends up flares about plunging meat prices due to delayed exports. All of these losses to a host of smaller industries mount up fast, but look at the Sunday Times report on the crisis in a car industry that's worth £42 billion in exports, employing 823,000 people, where car part delays are halting production at some factories. Yet still, most economically dead is the unseen slipping away of invisibles, where about 80% of the economy in services is already leaking tax revenues. Bloomberg keeps up its grim recording of no likely progress. It reports City of London's plight laid bare as Brexit deal hopes fade. And then there is the unfolding Northern Ireland disaster. Stena Line Ferries has diverted its Great Britain Northern Ireland sea crossings to the Rosslare to Cherbourg route instead. The Times headline reads, "Doldrums ahead in shipping forecasts as Brexit complicates customs." Over the past year, I have been following the impending haulage disaster through Manfreight, a 200-lorry company in Coleraine. Its owner, Chris Slowey, says no, the crisis in Great Britain, United Kingdom crossing, is not down to teething problems, as Dominic Raab put it, but it's baked into the nature of Brexit. His lorries carrying exports to England return empty, doubling his costs as English exporters find it too costly to sell to Northern Ireland, and that's permanent. The Telegraph reports that 1 in 10 lorries are being turned back at the European Union border. Delays will continue. Spot checks at EU borders are standard practice. So will queues, lorry parks and roadside squalor. The pandemic has worsened the Brexit effect, but that was a good reason to extend the transition period. It's only human to confess to some Remainer I told you so glee when ex-MP Kate Hoey wails in the Telegraph. The Tories have betrayed Northern Ireland with their Brexit deal. What on earth did she expect? That's why Northern Ireland wisely voted to remain. Expect a lot more shocked Brexiters to discover what they have done. The Brexit cabinet itself is on a steep learning curve. Here's one Telegraph columnist who writes, "We Brexiters are being blamed for the problems we warned about. In reality, the fault lies squarely with the government and with poor planning." Oh, the Schadenfreude. That's a sharp U-turn from the Telegraph's too eager January 1st report from the Dover front. Chaos? What chaos? As Brexiteers turn on each other, Brexit politics moves fast. Until now, the Tories plan to move on, only reviving Brexit-done triumphalism to re-arouse the captured red wall at the election. Labour just wanted to bury the whole issue. But the scale of the eruptions bursting out in one sector after another requires opposition to find its footing on this tricky terrain. Many, like Paul Joyer on Hastings Beach, are still as passionately pro-Brexit as ever. Fearlessly, Labour needs to regain its voice of outrage that Brexit leaders deliberately shut their ears to what leaving the single market and the customs union really meant. A better Brexit deal really was possible.
Around the World with Reporters.
In July 2020, following the enforcement of new national security laws on Hong Kong by China, the UK announced plans to expand visa rights to Hong Kong residents who claimed British National Overseas or BNO status before Britain handed over its former colony in 1997. Until recently, BNO passports did not give Hong Kong citizens the right of residence in the UK, but Number 10 has now changed the rules.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain, with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship, and that is precisely what we will do now.
China and Hong Kong both say this violates the Sino-British Declaration that paves the way for Hong Kong to return to Chinese rule. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam says the BNO is a form of travel document, not a form of nationality.
If one side, and that is the UK government, tries to deviate from that mutual understanding and bilateral agreement, then of course it's legitimate for the other side, that is the Central People's Government, to consider any countermeasures. And the Hong Kong SAR government will of course support any countermeasures to be adopted by the Central People's Government.
UK-China relations deteriorated in 2020. The UK banned Chinese telecom giant Huawei from the build-out of the UK's 5G network. It put forward a proposal to screen and block certain mergers and acquisitions from Chinese investors on national security grounds. And as a former colonial power decided to throw its weight around, declaring China's national security laws on Hong Kong to be a breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. On this pretext, Number 10 is offering almost three quarters of Hong Kong's population a fast-track route to British citizenship, stoking fears of brain drain in the city, especially in its healthcare system. England alone has around 50,000 vacancies for registered nurses, and the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown the NHS's staffing crisis into stark relief. Brexit has made sourcing health professionals from Europe much more difficult, and strict immigration policies also make recruitment from abroad very challenging. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war games is to evaluate the mobility and defense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile defense units of the Army Ground Forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi, JOSC.
Amid the recent growing of coronavirus infections in Israeli jails and the medical negligence of Israeli-Palestinian prisoners' conditions, the Palestinian Legislative Council, along with the Ministry of Palestinian Prisoners, held a press conference to express concerns of the serious condition of the prisoners at Israeli jails. Palestinians demanded an urgent action from the international community to save their life.
Our prisoners are dying inside the Israeli jails as the Israeli regime is practicing a slow death policy against them. The Israeli regime doesn't provide the infected prisoners with the required medical care. The international community should step in to save our prisoners' lives.
According to Palestinian Prisoners Organization, over 250 prisoners are diagnosed with the coronavirus, and the number is expected to rise due to the intentional medical neglect at Israeli jails, as Israel has stalled delivery of the vaccine to the Palestinian prisoners. Palestinians also demanded an international supervision to vaccinate the Palestinian prisoners and make sure they are delivering the required health care.
Palestinian prisoners are facing a serious danger that threatens their lives. Israel is using this virus against our prisoners to put further pressure on them. The coronavirus has already reached a number of Israeli jails and infected almost 250 Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian sources say over 5,000 Palestinians are currently detained in Israeli jails, mostly with no charge. Palestinian resistance has warned that they won't remain silent and hold Israel responsible for the consequences of neglecting the health condition of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners' issue is among our top priorities, and we will do our best to set our Palestinian inmates free. The resistance holds the Israeli regime responsible for all the consequences of this dangerous move.
Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to suppress the outrage at the detention. While some 5,000 Palestinian inmates are suffering in Israeli jails amid the coronavirus pandemic, Israel has deprived them from their right to health care. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of the International Webinar of Parliaments Supporting Palestine. Organized by Iran's parliament, the event was attended by parliament speakers and deputy speakers from Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries, as well as representatives of Palestine's resistance movements to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their resistance against Israel's occupation. Delegates condemned Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain for their normalization of ties with Israel, calling it a betrayal to the Muslim community.
It's a bitter tragedy to see that Palestinians' houses are demolished on a daily basis. 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are living in a prison-like area, and 5 million members of the Palestinian diaspora are not given their legitimate right to return to their homeland. What's even more tragic is that some Muslim countries have given the seal of approval to Israel's crimes by establishing political and economic ties with the occupying regime.
We call on the parliaments of all Muslim and Arab countries to take serious measures against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and especially the unwelcome deal of the century that seeks to change the identity of Palestinians and their land.
The Arab-Israeli normalization came as part of outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century. The plan, which triggered a storm of condemnations from Palestinians, refers to Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and recognizes Israeli sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. While the controversial deal was championed by Trump, observers say the incoming U.S. administration is not likely to change course on Palestine.
For me as a Palestinian and the previous experience of all American presidents, they are, and especially Biden, he's having a big heritage of literature to support the security of Israelis. And he did nothing when he was the vice president during Obama's time for the Palestinian, except that speech and rhetorics, and we have gained nothing.
Palestinian ambassador to Iran says resistance remains the only way ahead of his people against Israel's occupation, since he believes that the path of dialogue does not work with Israel.
We have to unite our forces to be strong front, and all the Arabs and Islamic world will stand behind us. No other way, because they have proved always that they are not loyal to negotiations or to any other settlement with them.
Although the Arab-Israeli normalization infuriated the Muslim world, commentators say it should not come as a surprise, and it's only a revelation of their long-existing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power equations. Delegates at the webinar underlined that Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, adding that Israel and its Western supporters have spared no effort in derailing that priority. They called on Muslim countries to stay united, as they believe this is the main counterforce against Israel's expansionist agenda. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
. 2021 has so far been miserable for millions of business people and their staff across the 27-country European Union. Lots of outlets are being forced to close their doors to prevent the spread of COVID-19, with only essential retailers allowed to remain open.
You see that we have stricter measures than even a few months ago all around Europe.
Finance ministers from the 19-nation Eurozone have just concluded their first meeting of 2021 and warned that social inequality in the EU has yet to peak. Government and personal debt is rising due to the pandemic, we are reminded that the bloc has pre-existing economic problems. For example, in Greece, youth unemployment was running at almost 50% even before COVID-19 came along.
Do not forget the situation in Italy, where proper tax system is not in place, and France is facing enormous problems of unemployment.
The EU's spending watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, has been examining the bloc's initial response to the pandemic. During an online interview, a spokesperson told us that better cooperation is required.
Indeed, the EU has to learn lessons going forward, both to react better to the COVID crisis, but indeed to pandemics in the future, because pandemics aren't going away. There will be another one in the future.
EU finance ministers say COVID-19 recovery funding needs to be released without delay and spent wisely by member states. Meanwhile, the bloc's crucial vaccination programme is being rolled out too slowly, many health experts argue. Because the bloc is still in the middle of a health emergency and the start of a new economic crisis, analysts say the EU's response will not be fully assessed by citizens until the pandemic passes. Based on current information, perhaps their verdict will not be good. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch Regional Director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel, as an occupying power, to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel, as an occupying power, must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintain that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130. But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
Faced with the dilemma of holding or postponing an election in the midst of a pandemic, politicians in Catalonia have chosen to heed health experts' advice to adjourn a February election as a surge in coronavirus cases threatened to overwhelm hospitals in what local media perceive as the third wave of the pandemic.
In the coming weeks, everyone needs to focus exclusively on the evolution of the pandemic and on the need to avoid the collapse of the healthcare system.
The pro-independence government picked May 30th as the chosen date for the next poll.
It's simply because that's when health experts believe the pandemic will subside and conditions will get better. It's the end of the cold season, the contagion will be reduced, and most of all, we are likely to have vaccinated a large part of the population by then.
All parties agreed to postpone the election, but the Socialist Party of Catalonia, the offshoot of Spain's Socialist Party leading the central government in Madrid, said the date was too far away.
What we object is that some have taken advantage of the legitimate fears about the COVID-19 to advance a different agenda. We believe that some parties seem to have taken into account what the polls say more than what the health data say.
Latest opinion polls show the separatists leading a majority in the 135-seat regional parliament, possibly passing the 50% symbolic threshold for the first time. But growing divisions between the two largest pro-independence blocs, led by Oriol Junqueras from jail and Carles Puigdemont from exile, suggest they may seek new alliances to form a new government.
With the vote on hold, the focus in Catalonia now is on the evolution of the contagion in the coming weeks and the progress of vaccination. There's a shared feeling that the more people get the vaccine, the safer the environment for in-person voting. Cusay Kadri, Barcelona.
The final sun is setting on the presidency of Donald J. Trump. Domestically, many are not just breathing a sigh of relief, but screaming with happiness. And yet polls say 35% of the country believes he is being ousted illegitimately. That illustrates just how polarizing Trump has been here, and while many wonder if he'll run for president in 2024, many others hope he is leaving public office permanently.
Alhamdulillah, that tomorrow is Trump's last day in the White House as the president of the United States. I don't feel that it is Trump's last day as being a tyrant, being a terrorist, being a thief. But I feel that I'm very happy that that we can get back to moving forward here in the United States.
Trump seemed to combine Barack Obama's skill in manipulating the media, George W. Bush's readiness to provoke international hatred, Bill Clinton's ability to disregard the truth, and Ronald Reagan's jingoism. He was routinely and credibly accused of conduct which degraded public service, of re-legitimizing American white supremacy, of intentionally provoking societal rifts, and much, much more. Trump's ascension provoked the greatest burst of political activity and independent journalism in the U.S. in 50 years. Black Lives Matter, Me Too, the importance of voting, and other progressive movements seem to be in direct response to his regular use of sexism, racism, jingoism, and elitism. Internationally, Trump took America's post 9/11, you're either with us or against us worldview to a new extreme. He illegally tore up international agreements, banned travel from seven mostly Muslim countries, and antagonized longtime U.S. allies. Trump, who switched his party affiliation 5 times, has successfully reshaped the Republican Party. He was the first 21st century mainstream politician to be openly anti-free trade, to voice opposition to America's endless wars, to admit the national decline of the U.S. since the Great Recession, to bring attention to the role of a deep state in the U.S., and to openly question the integrity of the nation's corporate-dominated media. The Trump era was